Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 376th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. The universe.
The universe. You might want to do Earth first.
Come
down to Earth.
We just went right to the entire universe.
Okay, I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Alberta.
And for those of you who have not been stoned the last two podcasts, you will marginally remember that we went through the systematic review that Mike and all the gang at in Alberta and did in absolute detail, but with crystal clear messages. And from all of that information, we put together and published this just recently, the what we call a simplified guideline for prescribing medical cannabinoids in primary care. And we thought what we would do is go through that sort of thought process of how we took all of the evidence and then, you know, put it into a guideline to talk about here's a reasonable approach to how you can deal with medical cannabinoids.
Right. And so just to put some context in, James is a co-author in this, and it was mainly because the origin of the idea, James said to me, why don't we do marijuana?
Yes.
And I think I might have misinterpreted
you
this
did?
And started a research project.
Yeah, yeah. Right. The fact that we were sitting in a hot tub at the time and I said, let's do marijuana. I don't know how you misinterpreted it, but we'll go with it.
Okay, so what we've got here is, of course, the usual cast of characters at Peer or involved in Peer that helped get a lot of this work done, and that is Tina and Mike and Sharon and Adrian and James, of course. And then we've got some people who are part of Peer now, too, with the PLP program, the Physician Learning Program, and they're Danielle, Joey, and Jameel, and Karen was part of the group. Gijay. And so we've got all these people, and then we've got the actual guideline committee. These are the people who actually looked over the evidence and made decisions on recommendations. So I just wanted to recognize them. And they are Nathan, Nicole, Beverly, Ruth, Ted, Jessica, Michael, and Ken Makis and Zaifu. So those are the people that you can blame if you don't like the recommendations. But I think they're really quite sensible, and it was a great team to work with. So let's get to the actual gist of it. So what we do in any kind of guideline is we look over the evidence and we try and come up with recommendations. And there's a very much an iterative process where you're addressing issues that the guideline committee raises that remain unclear. Like, does it work for seizures? Does it? What's the difference between CBD and THC and in the clinical trials and all of that kind of stuff. So that came up, even though the systematic review, which we talked about the last two podcasts, doesn't necessarily address those. We'll talk a bit about that as we go through. And so as James mentioned, it's published in Canadian Family Physician. It's also available on the Toward Optimized Practice website. And we're going to jump into the recommendations rather than boring you with all the additional kind of background content of the methods and all that. But we also, some of the other questions that came up though, does it help for appetite stimulation? Does it help for treating headaches? Can it cause, one of the members had seen pulmonary aspergillosis as a result of it. So questions around what's the risk of that? And what about the oral cannabinoids? Because most of them were the buccal or buccal spray. Mm-hmm. And then just some comparative drug information, which we'll get to in a minute. So the guidelines
just as a sort of a review, we identified only three conditions that really had reasonable evidence, and that was chronic pain, nausea, vomiting, and spasticity. And the bottom line is the entire guideline is challenged because of a lack of high level research. And so what then you have to do is sort of work your way around that, and also realizing. And I think you'd agree, Mike, that the most common use or reason that people want this is, well, probably just to smoke marijuana. But the next one is
I, I don't know if I'd go that far asking for medical marijuana.
No, but just a smoke but then
but I get you, yeah.
Yeah, but for chronic pain.
Yeah,
that's the main chronic use of it. Number, yeah. So we yeah. so we'll. Number, go ahead.
I was just going to say number two is mental health, yeah. and of that, anxiety dominates. But yeah, we'll yeah. talk about that specifically. So the guideline is really designed as a shared informed decision-making document. It's mm-hmm. Meant for that purpose. So clinicians can discuss with their patients kind of the risks and benefits of the interventions and also like the key recommendations, but it's designed to allow shared decision-making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it perfect? There's still other stuff we could do, I'm sure, but I think you'd agree, James, it goes a little bit further than most guidelines.
Yeah, and I think one thing that when we, these simplified guidelines that we put together, we come into them with the concept of if all else fails, we should be doing shared decision making. And it actually very much influences the tone and the approach to what we would put in a guideline. And interestingly, very few guidelines actually do this. So we're quite proud, I think, of using that as the, and in fact, under the recommendation, that's the very first heading.
Yeah, exactly. So so let's just give some examples for general medical conditions. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important for people to recognize. So for glaucoma, for example, which you often hear, and if you watch The Simpsons, like James and I do, you'll know that when Homer received medical marijuana, it was for treatment of his glaucoma. And that is based on one RCT of six patients, which found it didn't really work.
Yeah. So, and one of those patients was Homer.
So just to give some context, and I lead with that because I think it's so important to understand this is one of those foundational things that we all know that it works for glaucoma, but here we have the highest level evidence, which makes it quite iffy, really. Mm-hmm. There are four appetite stimulation studies that we looked at. Two found no difference. This is for patients with HIV. Two found no difference. One found approximately 2 kilogram improvement with cannabinoids, and another found progesterone is better by 8 kilograms over cannabinoids. For seizure disorder, there's a bunch of small trials that are in a Cochrane review. Four of them range from anywhere from 9 to 15 patients, and they said there was really nothing reliable. But then in 2017, just last year, we got an RCT with a cannabidiol for resistant seizures, a syndrome called Dravet syndrome. It's for refractory seizures that occur in pediatric patients. And so these kids have been on a lot of things, and so we're kind of looking for what else might work. They found a benefit with this, dropping seizure frequency from about 12 to 15 down, or I think it was 12 to 15 to 14 down to 6 in the treatment arm and 14 in the, or 12 in the placebo arm. So pretty considerable improvement. That's the average monthly rate of seizures. And 50% improvement in seizures didn't quite reach statistical significance, but again, there was a numeric, it looked like it was going to, if the trial was bigger, it just would have found a numeric advantage of about a 15% overall improvement in getting a 50% reduction seizure. So to me, this was a good trial. For those of you who haven't looked at that trial, it doesn't really apply to us in primary care. We don't see Dravet syndrome, and if we did, if we had a patient with it, we'd be involving peds neuro or someone else. But it is an important trial because it to me, it's one of the best design trials, and it kind of does say, yes, this drug, even in a good study like this, shows an effect. Yeah. So,
and I was going to say, and when you sort of see, at least for this, for these sort of medical conditions for which there's, you know, very marginal evidence, I mean, the only sort of approach that you can take is, And I know in the guideline it says we recommend against the use of medical or cannabinoids for these sorts of conditions. But, you know, sometimes you get, you know, pushed into a corner. And as long as one has tried all the other more proven treatments and they have not worked or the patient can't tolerate them or so on, you know, it may be of value to at least give this a try. But that's, you know, yeah. that's sort of the approach. But that we're basically explaining what we do in medicine on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. Guidelines aren't meant to be dictatorial or anything like that. Thou shalt never consider. So when we say things like recommend against, what we're meaning is for the vast majority of patients. And I think all of us need to be clinicians still. And there's times I think you and I would not strictly follow guidelines. I know you're far more.
We would follow our own guidelines. There's many guidelines I wouldn't follow because I don't think they're very evidence based. But that's a whole other podcast, which we've done at length.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we're not meaning, but this is, the guidelines should be done for the majority of patients and the majority of clinical decisions. So let's move on to mental health, because that's the big one that is number two on most studies show that when patients request medical cannabinoids, they're requesting it for mental health conditions. So what do we have out there? Well, for depression, there is actually no RCTs. For anxiety in general, any anxiety condition, there is one RCT of 24 patients who performed a simulated public speaking activity. And so this is just a one-day thing. And then were to rate themselves on a couple different scales. And one, the mood visual analog scale was improved. So it's not particularly dramatic. It certainly has no, that was for a kind of social phobia and particularly public speaking. It doesn't really have to do with general anxiety disorder. It doesn't have to do with OCD or panic attack, or panic disorder. None of those three big ones that we see with in the anxiety cluster, none of those have been studied. So interestingly enough, very little research on that, which is unfortunate. There's one on post-traumatic stress disorder. It was an RCT of 10 patients, which did find some improvement in some outcomes. However, it should be noted that the other studies that are cohorts, which are much bigger, found actually sometimes worsening of symptoms with medical marijuana in particular. So it does beg the question of uncertainty with only 10 people studied thus far. There are some big trials coming out there, though, which does give us some hope that we'll get a clear answer soon. And that's it, guys, for the things that, you know, you often hear about, like seizures, appetite, glaucoma, and mental health. We've gone through all the evidence, James. It was a bit overwhelming, wasn't it?
Yeah. I thought you'd never stop. There's so much of it. But you know, and so again, it's kind of an interesting thing because, you know, if you get a patient coming into you who has already, you know, is already using their own marijuana and says, you know what, when I use it for whatever the conditions that we're talking about, it seems to improve. I mean, it's kind of like when we talk about, and I don't even like the word alternative medicine, I kind of go, well, I'm really glad it helped. As long as they're not avoiding other proven treatments or other ones that might be safer and or less expensive, you know, it's really hard to argue because we can't say for sure one way or the other because the evidence isn't clear. So again, that's sort of how one acts as a healthcare provider is to deal with all of the nuances around the evidence. So
I would caution a little bit there with things like GAD and like general anxiety and that kind of thing, because when people are smoking cannabinoids, obviously for the population that doesn't get the dysphoric effect and all of that, it can be that feeling of sedation and euphoria and all of that could relieve some anxiety symptoms. But is it actually treating the underlying condition? So in 4 hours or 6 hours, as it wears off, do your symptoms return?
But do you see that any different than using, you know, low dose benzodiazepines or?
Absolutely. That was my example. So there's some examples but we would talk, I think most psychiatry guidelines and recommendations would be around avoiding the use of chronic benzos, short acting benzos to relieve GAD when they would advocate for the use of SSRIs, SNRIs, CBT, like counseling and all of those things.
No doubt.
That's all my
point. Yeah, but I mean, and your point, and you mentioned this in previous podcasts, you know, you've got the, you know, this very small number of patients that you see, that the only thing that seems to work is just a little bit of a benzodiazepine, and they, you know, they don't abuse it. It just helps them function. And in that case, you just go, great.
Absolutely. I don't panic about those, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
So that's kind of the background of all the other conditions other than the three that James mentioned. And if we have algorithms in the actual guideline, which basically say, are you considering medical cannabinoids, and is it for neuropathic pain, palliative pain? So we group those two pains together for when we say three conditions, spasticity, or chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. And if it's not for those, then we recommend against, and with all the caveats that James mentioned right at the beginning. And then if it's yes, then there's some conditions, of course, and we're gonna get into that, the conditions now for pain, because I think that's the main one that we need to talk about. And so we mentioned a bit of this before on the last podcast, the research for other types of pains like fibromyalgia, osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, back pain. The amount of data there is really quite poor, and it's unfortunate because back pain is one of the most common pain syndromes we see. Neuropathic pain is less common than back pain for sure. And yet we have a whole host of randomized controlled trials for neuropathic pain and one for back pain. Mm-hmm. So we don't really, not a very big size either, so we don't really have enough to support most pain conditions. But for neuropathic pain, I've already mentioned a bit of this, but just to, as a reminder, when we're looking at pain improvement, we're kind of looking at a 30, 33% or a third improvement in their pain, how many people get to there. So that means going from about a 6 pain down to about a 4 pain level on a pain scale. And when we look at that, the risk ratio was 1.37. That means that about over placebo, about 37% relative more people will get a benefit. But as you know, on this podcast, we always try and talk about what is the absolute benefit. So let's jump there. That means that, and you can think often that a lot of placebo effect is kind of around a 25, 30% for pain. This will take you from that 30% placebo improvement up to a 39%. So 30% get better in placebo, 39% get better who have received medical cannabinoids. Recognizing, of course, what we talked about earlier, that most of that research is in nabiximols and things like that, not necessarily in smoke. But regardless, there you have it. That's kind of the benefit we're talking about. We showed already that it's questionable whether it's even that good. So because there's a number of biases, and our sensitivity analysis showed that larger, longer studies showed less or no effect. So with that in mind, though, we've got palliative care, overall pain rather, getting about a 9% benefit over placebo. That's the absolute. For neuropathic pain, it's about the same 8 to 9%. And for palliative care, it's about a 7% absolute pain improvement. If you're looking at a change in scale, it's going from a 6, placebo gets you down to around a 5, and this gets you down to around 4.5 or so.
So the sort of the good thing about it is that, you know, roughly speaking, if you use it for these sort of this population, somewhere around, you know, let's say 40% of people will go, you know what, I think it had a benefit that was worthwhile. But because 30% of that 40%, if you will, is because of what you would have seen if you would have done nothing or in the placebo group, you know, you're still looking at 4 out of 10 people will benefit. But of those four, only one of those four are benefiting because of the medication. So it's why we, you know, go with all the principles of starting with low doses, reevaluating on a regular basis. But that's what the best available evidence tells us.
Right. And so that leads us to where the recommendations are. Mm-hmm. And that is for acute pain. We've talked about that. It clearly doesn't work there from all the research we have. So we strongly recommend against it for acute pain. For headache, rheumatologic pain, we also said we recommend against the use of medical cannabinoids. The reason is in those cases, the research is just too poor to support a recommendation. In neuropathic pain, we said we recommended against it for first and second line, but it could be considered for refractory neuropathic pain with the following conditions. And as always, every sentence starts the same way. All the conditions start the same way. A discussion taking place about the risks and benefits. And then we give some of those numbers, which we just gave to you, and we gave you all of the adverse event list last time. Mm-hmm. And then patients have a reasonable therapeutic trial of three or more medicines. They've already had that. Mm-hmm. So that would be in the genre of neuropathic pain. That would be things like amitriptyline or a TCA, something along the lines of a gabapentin, pregabalin, and then something in the SNRI cluster like a duloxetine or venlafaxine.
And the main reason is there are literally no head-to-head comparisons, so we can't even say one is better than another. But in general, and we talked about the adverse reactions associated with cannabinoids, is on the face of it, it looks like they have more adverse events.
Yeah, that's right.
And so when you have likely no, they may be close to equally effective, but they have more adverse events. And again, this is all average numbers. So there are many people who will get no benefit from medical cannabinoids, and there'll be people who get benefit and no side effects, but then there'll be people who get side effects. And the same goes for people can't tolerate the tricyclic, so they can't tolerate the gabapentin. These are just all averages, and that's where you start from.
Yeah, exactly. We'll talk a little bit more about if you were to guess at where the benefits are. We'll talk about that for the other products a bit in just a second, because I think the listeners can, we should encourage you to access the guideline and go to for the guideline that is on the Canadian Family Physician website. There's a tab you'll see called CFP Plus for this specific guideline. And when you open that up, you'll see a one pager, which is basically the only tool you'll need for discussion with patients. And then the other one is a pamphlet for patients. It's called the e-brochure. And that will solve a lot of your heartache as far as the cannabinoid stuff goes, because it's a really easy tool to talk about the risks and benefits and show some comparative treatments. But let's just jump to palliative for one sec. So for palliative, we also made a recommendation, even though the evidence was a bit weaker with palliative and didn't seem to have quite the same effect, we said that still not first or second line, but it could be considered for refractory pain. And in this case, because we're moving to opioids much quicker, and we felt that really, if you're in that genre, you're also in the looking at cannabinoids as well. So we said a trial of two agents and shared informed decision making, of course, and considering it as an adjunctive therapy. But really, it could be considered in those patients as well. We thought, even though the evidence isn't there, who knows, maybe there is a tiny bit of weight improvement and maybe a tiny bit of control of the nausea and vomiting, even though not well studied at all.
And if at all possible, if you can avoid our opioids.
Yeah.
That may be why you started a little bit earlier than some of the things for neuropathic pain. But again,
right. And
yeah.
Go ahead, James.
No, that was it.
And so I was just going to say that the other thing, that even if it is using opioids, at least this might allow you to get away with much lower doses of them.
Yeah.
Right. Because you're augmenting the two pain agents. So.
Yeah. And that's actually a very legitimate point, because there's, and it doesn't apply to every pain area, but most people suggest that using lower doses of one or two different, not one, lower doses of a couple medications is you will often get a greater benefit than just increasing the dose of a single agent. And so, you know, we've seen that, you see that in
blood pressure.
Blood pressure, but you also see it in things like dental pain, post-surgical pain and things like that, that a little bit of, sort of a medium dose of two is better than a big dose of one thing. And so, you know, that sort of attacking it from different angles is probably the best way to try it.
And then the last thing we'll say is that the recommendations in this case, we recommended actually trying rather than smoked, because it has obviously potential harms that go beyond the ones that we could measure from randomized controlled trials. And what I'm talking about here is the potential long-term harms of smoking. So we recommended one of the pharmaceutical derived first, like nabilone or nabiximols. The problem with nabiximols is that they're generally not covered and they're quite expensive. And when I say quite expensive, it turns out they're the same price as medical marijuana, the smoked medical marijuana or oils. So we'll talk about the prices later, but that's just to give some context of what we generally recommend is not going to smoked marijuana first.
Yeah. Although I would suggest, you know, if it's in palliative for palliative pain, you know, the issue of,
yeah,
you know, cancer or chronic obstructive lung disease, sadly, that's probably not going to be the issue.
Yeah, you're totally right. Yeah. It was mainly for the neuropathic pain.
Yeah.
You were talking about that. Let's just talk really briefly now about our comparative guide, because I think that's quite relevant to this conversation. And on the one pager, we provide the algorithm, the kind of expected benefits from cannabinoids in the primary conditions discussed, the harms and or side effects, and then the last thing is the doses and cost. But on the other side of that sheet, so that's why we call our guidelines simplified. We fit everything, all of that information on a single page. And it's not super small either. We don't compensate by that way. Yeah. So it's
and just, really, just so, is the just so you know, so note to other guideline raters, it can be done in 1 to 2 pages for most things.
Absolutely, because this whole guideline really boils down to, and I think you'd agree, one page, James.
And it's not because we just couldn't come up with better stuff. It's just that when you whittle it all down, there are key messages and thought processes, especially if you're focusing on shared decision making.
Yeah, it becomes way easier. But we'll tell you about this, the neuropathic pharmacotherapy comparator. And so what this does is it allows you to look at icon arrays of the different agents, and we rank them by their benefits over placebo. So what we did in this is we, because the studies all had different rates of placebo effect varying from kind of 15 to 40%, so we kind of averaged them all out to around 25. And then we put the relative benefits on them to get what we can expect, how many patients will actually benefit from therapy. So when you look at these, you'll see that there's a certain number of red faces. Those are people who don't get to that 30% improvement. There's yellow ones, the ones that get there because they, because of placebo. And that's not the placebo pill. It's not a sugar pill. It's the idea that patients are naturally going to get better and have periods of being better. Once you start taking care of them, following them up regularly, seeing them on a regular basis, providing additional advice and assistance. And so that kind of captures that. And then the last part is the green faces, which are the ones that demonstrate how many people actually get better from the drug. So when you look at this or reading it, you would tell a patient, if you use amitriptyline, there's a 50% of patients will feel a third reduction in their pain, a reduction in their pain by a third. Only about half of those will be because of the drug, but still, as you mentioned before, James, about 50. When you look at it from many of the other agents, they're somewhere between kind of 43% of patients getting better and 38% of patients getting better. And what I wanted to say here that's so important is high-dose opioids are in this same cluster as pregabalin, venlafaxine, gabapentin, duloxetine. They're all kind of have a very, very similar chance of making patients feel better. And the opioid studies to get to that were at what is considered now high dose, so 90 milligrams and up. And they have tons of adverse events, obviously. So it's a good reminder to us that we don't need to be jumping to opioids very quickly at all, because the other drugs are just as good or better.
Yeah. And certainly that very much applies to sort of, there was just a recent trial, and we'll probably talk about this on a later podcast, showing that, you know, going the opioid route for chronic pain associated with osteoarthritis and other things like that, there is no advantage of those products on average over just the normal going down the other pathway of things like acetaminophen, NSAIDs, and the sort of the neuropathic-y pain type medications.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me that we've kind of, and so what I like about this icon array or graphic is that it shows really clearly that these drugs are all very similar. The one that stands out as the least effective is cannabinoids, actually. Mm-hmm. And only 34% will benefit there, and only 9 people out of the 100 will benefit because of the drug. Mm-hmm. So it's it's kind of a step down from all others. And so if you're wondering, it's not just the adverse events, it's also that this drug, from this data, which we acknowledge is indirect comparisons, appears to be less effective than the others.
And unfortunately, none of them are wonderfully effective.
No, none. Yeah. Even amitriptyline. And to be honest, when you look at the amitriptyline evidence, I think most people who've looked at it would tell you that there's a chance that it's exaggerated its effectiveness because the trials are old and not very well done. So they're probably very similar to all of them.
Yeah.
And gabapentin, duloxetine, all of that.
Right. So
trials are actually... Oh, go ahead, James.
No, just go ahead and finish what you're doing, because I was going to say we'll probably end it after we've talked about pain and then go on to leave another podcast for the other conditions.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just going to say that some of the best research for pain is coming from the newer agents, particularly duloxetine, because they actually got marketing authority for that, so they had to do good trials. And they have pretty good trials in OA and neuropathic pain. Not that they're much better.
Yeah,
but
no, exactly.
If you're someone who's concerned about quality of studies, they actually did a fairly good job. So anyhow, I agree with you. Let's end it here, because I think we've kind of summed up the overall other agents and chronic pain, which is by far the biggest issue for prescribing these. And we're left with the two smaller things, nausea and vomiting and spasticity, which we'll be able to do quickly, and then briefly end on kind of how are these actually being used and how are we prescribing them?
Yeah, no, exactly. So, and like I said, we'll talk about nausea, vomiting, and spasticity and all that sort of stuff, and then maybe some just general prescribing sort of considerations that we'll talk about. So just a very quick reminder to everyone that our course in Vancouver is coming up May 4th and May 5th. We are selling out rapidly. I think we're 2/3 full, maybe a little bit more. So if you're interested in coming to the course, I would suggest that you sign up, and we would love to see you attend. I think we will maybe be talking a little bit about medical cannabinoids, or cannabinoids, if you will, at that course, and a whole plethora of other things. But we will not be selling it because it won't be legal yet.
Which, if it was...
Oh.
You would definitely have been selling it as part of the conference.
Absolutely, yeah. You'd be surprised how many more people would show up.
So, morals and ethics? Did you get a good price for them? I think that's my biggest question.
Oh yeah, and it's high quality.
Okay, good.
As most people know, when we get to this point in the podcast, there is no value to continue to listen. So. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Okay. Talk to you later.